A rite of passage might not come with the ceremony, but it can definitely follow soon after it. In our final story of the show, I leave the safety of the university campus and bring you the tale of my first post-college job, a story full of violence, drugs, and me, cowering in the bathroom. I didn't take my first post-college job for the money, or the glamour. It was just a summer job at a tiny newspaper. But I took it because the editor ended one of his emails to me with the following line: "We've got murder and poverty coming out of our ears tomorrow, so I'll sign off." Well, that line, and because I didn't have many other job prospects, but mainly for the murder and poverty. I don't like murder and poverty. I was just excited to get a taste of that thing college seniors timidly refer to as the real world. I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't have much life experience to draw on. A middle-class upbringing and 4 years of a liberal college education had bred a desire for something gritty, like murder and poverty. Combined with my desire to write, I felt like I needed some test to see if I could hack it as a reporter out in the real world. The newspaper seemed like the perfect place to find the test. It covered a poor, agricultural community north of Sacramento in California's Central Valley. The area had a few familiar sights, like a Walmart and a Starbucks, but beyond that, it was completely alien to me. On first glance, the town seemed dead or dying. Empty buildings and storefronts were scattered throughout the downtown. Billboards showing toothless addicts warned of the malady eating away at communities there and throughout the rest of rural California: meth. The only jobs were in agriculture, and they were handled by migrant workers. There was no need for the young and the educated to stick around. The newspaper itself can be best described as scrappy, or, as others have put it, stirring. The office had been ransacked, shot at, and firebombed, and the lug nuts on my editor's car were loosened while I was there. It seemed like half the county loved the paper, and the other half hated it, with a level of loathing typically reserved for third-world dictators or conservative talk radio hosts. I was laughed at in person and screamed at on the phone. If you don't want to read headlines like "Why are cops holding women open for catheters?" or see the bloody face of a car accident victim, this isn't the paper for you. But if you are poor, harassed, or just think someone should keep an unblinking eye trained on the local government, consider a subscription. I wasn't alone in my quest. Joining me at the paper was a friend from college, Rahul. Rahul and I weren't particularly close at the time, but we decided it made sense financially to live together. The complex Rahul and I chose to live in was not the nicest place, but it met our most important qualification. It was cheap. The parking lot was unpaved, and it was rare if we didn't get at least 2 police visits a week, but that doesn't matter so much when college loans need to be repaid. The only thing that really worried me was the pack of children that roamed the grounds. The main group of them lived with their single, haggard mother in the apartment below me. To my eye, the kids were from 3 to 13, and they were fearless. The youngest of them approached me as I walked the grounds, or came up the stairs and knocked on the door of my second-floor apartment. One of their favorite games was, "Let's throw rocks at each other," and they liked to play it right next to my car. Rahul and I had no furniture, so we negotiated with our landlord to get beds, desks, and a kitchen table. The desks and table were normal enough, but the beds were just inflatable mattresses. That was the extent of our furnishings. The only item in the living room was a box of books that Rahul had brought. Not that it mattered. It was doubtful that we were going to do much entertaining. I stayed in the dorms throughout college, and I was looking forward to living in an apartment like a mature adult. I had always been messy as a child, and I wanted to keep the place as neat as possible. I also had dreams of cooking. I solicited recipes from my family, and my sister-in-law even sent me a basket with Bisquick and, at the suggestion of my brother, General Tso's chicken marinade. I envisioned coming home from the paper at night after a hard day of digging out the truth and cooking simple but elegant 3-course meals. I knew cleaning and cooking would be difficult enough for me, but I soon found they were going to be the least of my problems. My first story at the paper was a simple one. The editor called me over and told me to write a brief article on the wildfires in the surrounding counties. It was a boring assignment, but sure, I said, I can do that. I turned back towards my desk and walked quickly to the bathroom. I didn't throw up or anything. I just sat on the toilet and read press releases. All I needed to do was call up some people and ask a few questions. The trouble was, I didn't know what questions to ask. I didn't know how to do anything. After a few minutes, I calmed down and returned to my desk. I readied myself to make my first phone call and tried to squash the shame I felt for having to ready myself to make my first phone call. The calls went fine, and I wrote about as good of a story as you can about fires that aren't actually in the area you cover, but my flight to the toilet had replaced my initial euphoria with a healthy dose of fear. I wasn't afraid I'd be able to write quick news items. I could chalk that up to first day jitters. What worried me was how I would respond when I had to cover that real world I was desperate to see. I started to build my confidence back up the next couple weeks. I was writing a story on special education funding in the county. The districts were blaming the county for sudden payment spikes called billbacks, and the county was blaming them on the largest district. Everyone I talked to told me different things, and I was running around in circles. Some officials lied, some let me believe lies, and many others turned out to be completely clueless. I didn't figure out what was actually happening until the very end, much longer than it probably should have. But I did figure it out, and I printed the story. I realized that at some point, my stomach had stopped churning before I picked up the phone. My fear of calling up sources was replaced by a burning desire to figure out what the hell was going on. It felt good. Give me a fedora and call me a news hound. I was on the trail. I was unstoppable. I was on track at the office, but things weren't going quite as planned back at my apartment. Far from becoming a master chef, I had only cooked one meal, baked chicken with an Italian dressing marinade. It actually tasted good, but almost all of my meals came from a market around the corner from my office. Chicken tacos at lunch and a steak torta for dinner, cheap and delicious. Occasionally I fried eggs, but the only pan we had bought was a wok. We figured it would be more adaptable than a frying pan. I discovered it's really difficult to fry eggs on a curved surface. We still had not purchased any furniture, besides a computer chair Rahul bought at Walmart. But nevertheless, our apartment began to fill with trash. One day, late in the summer, I sat down at the kitchen table to describe the place in a journal I was keeping. Here are some excerpts. Our bathroom is now covered with hair. The counter, toilet, and bathtub rim are covered with a light dust of shaved hairs. In the corners of the floor, larger hairs have collected and started to clump. We use an old beach towel as a bath mat. It has not been washed since I've been here, and I do not think I'll ever wrap myself in it again. Next to the kitchen table is the box from Rahul's leather office chair, which has become our trash can and has never been emptied. It is overflowing with plastic bags full of more trash, an empty box of wine, a Cheez-It box, a box of Wheat Thins, an empty box of donuts, another carton of cigarettes, a ramen noodles wrapper, fast food bags, and an assortment of plates, plastic utensils, napkins, and balled up pieces of aluminum foil. The countertops are covered with a flat of cup of noodles, a box of Indian spices, dirty plastic bowls, a soup can, a piece of paper covered with a pile of cigarette butts, a stack of recipe cards, unused, a box of Bisquick, a bottle of General Tso's sauce, both also unused, an empty tub of yogurt, a cheese grater with cheese stuck in the holes on a plate, a roll of toilet paper, a container of salt, a box of raisins, a rolled-up bag of granola, mini napkins, and, in most places, a residue of spent oil from Rahul's cooking and my spilling his spent oil. My apartment was not the beautiful world I had imagined myself inhabiting, and that extended to the rest of the complex. The family that lived below us was frequently on my mind. All day the mother sat out on the porch smoking and yelling at her kids. Not that I could judge her. There was no husband in sight and she had a lot of kids to deal with. Mainly, I just felt sad for her and her family. I occasionally said hi in passing, but for the most part, I avoided contact with them. I didn't know what to say, I was uncomfortable walking to my car at home, and I was soon to rediscover discomfort at work, when I got a chance to take a step closer to contact with that real-world test I was seeking. My editor assigned me and Rahul to write a story on a homicide. The victim, a middle-aged laborer, was described to me by one friend as a nice guy when he was sober, and drunk, he was like anyone else. Well, not quite like anyone else. He had been arrested numerous times for public intoxication, harassing police officers, assault, and he had meth in his system when he died. His longtime girlfriend had even accused him of sexually harassing her daughters, though he was never convicted. He didn't seem like a great guy, but still, getting the back of your head bashed in while you're out walking your dog at night is a tough way for anyone to go. I was sharing the story with Rahul. He had a little more journalism experience than me, but nothing like this. Our editor tracked down the location of one of the girlfriend's daughters. He told Rahul that she would be at work at the AM/PM that evening, and that Rahul should go talk with her. I was relieved my editor hadn't told me. The prospect of walking into an AM/PM to ask a girl about a murdered man that might have molested her terrified me. But then, I started to feel that familiar sensation of shame. The whole reason I'd come to this town and this job was to get baptized in the fire of real journalism and emerge victorious. At the time, I was reading Once Upon a Distant War, about war correspondents charging into the bedlam of Vietnam, armed with only pen and paper. Here I was, afraid to talk to a girl in a convenience store. I went to Rahul's room and asked if he wanted me to go with him. He quickly said that I could go if I wanted, but it would be awkward if we both went. I still didn't want to do this, but I felt compelled to at least make some sort of effort, so we flipped a coin. I lost. My breathing quickened when I pulled up to the AM/PM. I was scared as hell, but also a little excited. This was it. The real thing. I was a journalist. I walked inside and saw an employee talking with a friend near the slushy machine. She was about my age and had a lip ring, matching the description I'd been given. I didn't really know what to do, so I walked around the store like I was browsing, fighting the very strong urge to flee this already awkward situation. After a while, she went back to the counter and started ringing up customers. I contemplated buying something, but decided it would be unprofessional to walk up to her with a big gulp and a bag of chips. When I got to the counter, I explained to her what I was doing. I was not smooth, and what's worse, I could watch myself conducting the interview in a security monitor positioned right behind her. It felt like one of those out-of-body experiences you hear about, where people say they saw themselves on the operating table. Except, in this situation, I was the surgeon, and not a very skilled one. The girl told me the murder victim was not a nice guy. "Yeah, I've heard a lot of mixed things about him," I mumbled lamely. She replied, "Well, I'd know. I lived with him for 10 years. I had to go into foster care because of him." I quickly asked the questions I needed and bolted the store. I was a bit shaken, but my heart pounded in exhilaration, though that didn't last long. I really hadn't done a good job, and in the end, Rahul and I didn't even get the story. Our editor told me later that it was a mistake to assign it to us in the first place. It was a blow to my pride, but I can't really argue with him. I had no idea how to investigate a murder, but what I cared about was that I had the guts to try. The summer still wasn't over yet, but I hadn't packed it in. I hate feeling awkward and uncomfortable, but I was still out there, looking for the story that would push my limits and give me that test. Something hard. With drugs and violence, and that X factor making it morally ambiguous. I soon found it, or rather, it found me. One afternoon, a woman called me and claimed that the county jail had withheld medical treatment from her over the weekend. She was being held there because she had hit her husband in a moment of rage. The woman had hepatitis C, contracted from her time as a meth user, though she told me she had been clean for a while. I called up some people at the jail, did some investigating, wrote a story, and thought that was the end of it. A couple days later, I got another call from the woman. She told me she had temporarily lost custody of her children a few weeks before when she had slapped one of her daughters. She was released and no charges had been filed against her, but her two daughters were still with a foster family. She wanted me to come out to her house for an interview. She said her lawyer was useless and thought maybe I could help her get her kids back. I didn't know a whole lot about this woman, and the little I did know did not make me very sympathetic to her case. She told me it was her Hep C medication that made her irritable, but now she was done with it. She was reformed, she said. She now read the Bible and walked the straight and narrow. So you say, I thought. But I agreed to come to her house to do an interview. As I pulled up at her house, my chest felt heavy, like at the AM/PM. But if I chickened out here, I couldn't buy a Snickers bar and act like a regular customer. The woman's home was a rundown farmhouse. I imagined it probably looked really nice at one point in time, but that point had long passed. The porch was weather-beaten and sagging. The paint peeled in some places and was completely absent in others. Things did not improve as I walked inside. It made my apartment seem like a good housekeeping photo spread. In high school, I had spent a year working as a carpet cleaner with my father. During that time, I only saw one carpet worse than this. It was in a slum hotel that we were cleaning for free, because the family that lived there had lost their mother and father in quick succession. We worked on the floors for about an hour, but the carpets, once green, still looked black. The woman gave me a tour, and the rest of the house had a similar appearance. The bathroom smelled foul, and the kitchen was a mess. I pictured the woman's two daughters in a clean house with the foster family, which, from what I had heard, was treating them well and wanted to keep them. I sat down in a threadbare chair and listened to the woman plead her case. She showed me character letters attesting to her parenting skills and the book she read from each night. She explained to me that she slapped her daughter only after finding out the girl was using hard drugs. In the other room, her 18-year-old son sat in front of the TV. I went in to speak with him and asked about the foster parents taking care of his sisters. He told me he thought they were trying to buy his sister's affections. Once they get custody, he said, they'll treat them bad. What if they're just nice people? I asked. He shook his head. No, he said. I have a lot of friends in foster care. They hate it. Should your sisters come home? I asked him. Yes, he said. I'll be here. Nothing bad will happen. I'm the peacekeeper. He told me the fight between his sister and mother was partially his fault, because he was not there to stop it. Back at the office, I sat in front of a blank document on my computer screen. I did not know what to write. I couldn't decide if the woman deserved to have her children back or not, or whether that was even relevant to my story. Looking back on it, that's the story I should have written. Instead, I published, as best I could, a straight accounting of the facts. I justified it with the argument of journalistic neutrality, but that was a cop-out. The story scared me. I thought back to a scene at my apartment complex. One day I was walking to my car, and I passed the apartment below mine. On the door was a note reminding the mother to call someone. One of her small children, too young to read, saw the note as I walked by and screamed in panic, "No! We're moving again!" I winced, like someone hit me. This family, which had been a curiosity to me at best, suddenly became real. I wondered what the kid had gone through to think he was losing his home just because a scrap of paper was taped to his door. This is what I had been looking for, the reason I had taken this job. But like with the story on the woman wanting her daughters back, I didn't know how to handle it. I could have just told him what the note said and calmed his fears, but I couldn't open my mouth. I just kept walking. If those experiences were tests, I'm pretty sure I didn't pass them. At least that's what I thought at the time, but now I'm not so sure. Maybe when you're young and trying to experience the world, you have to muddle through a bunch of experiences you aren't prepared for and fail again and again. As long as you don't quit and you keep asking for more, you can call it a win.